Our fifth case for this morning is Dunlop against Nestle Incorporated, 03-1752. And we will hear first from Mr. Barron.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. Donald Dunlop was lawfully at Nestle's property on September 9th, and he had a heart attack there. Now, it's undisputed he was their employee, but he was also lawfully on their premises. Makes no difference whether he was an independent contractor, whether or not he was a salesman. He was in a restricted location on their property. He had a heart attack. He was left lying on a pile of cardboard from 8:30 in the morning until, we think, approximately 4 o'clock in the afternoon. The district court granted summary judgment. The defendant moved or filed a motion to dismiss based on the affirmative defense of workers' compensation exclusivity. Ironically, we're in a position here, and procedurally, we're in a position here where the defendant has never filed an answer, has never filed even the affirmative defense. And now, without any discovery, their affirmative defense is granted in the form of a motion for summary judgment.
Could I ask you a couple of questions
Sure.
about the status of all of this? First of all, I take it that for 6 years and some, the Illinois Industrial Commission has been sitting on this workers' compensation case. Is that correct?
Your Honor, the question in your voice was in mine when I called yesterday afternoon to say, the first question I'm going to get when I get up there to Chicago is, what's going on? And there is a status conference set for April 20th in Jacksonville, Illinois. And I don't do workers' compensation, and more than that, I can throw up my hands and share your amazement.
I don't know whether that's a typical duration, but anyway, my next question is this, really. Focusing on what the district court decided, would you say that the district court decided that each of the four elements about workers' compensation cases in the Mirbray against Marshall Field case, et cetera, existed? In other words, that this was an accidental injury, that the injury arose, I mean, it's all phrased in the negative in that case, but you get to go forward with the case in the district court if it was not an accidental injury, it didn't arise from his employment, not received during the course of employment, or not compensable under the Act. And
the district court very clearly
necessarily
said
necessarily makes a finding on all of that.
Yes, and in fact,
why isn't that claim preclusive, issue preclusive on the Illinois Industrial Commission?
In front of that, yeah.
It's the same parties, and Illinois has a law of issue preclusion.
Right. Doesn't
that pin Nestle down to a finding that this is rightfully within the jurisdiction of the workers' compensation system?
I would think, and in fact you'll note a footnote in our brief that says just that. But I'm not litigating the workers' compensation proceeding. I think that they have throughout this attempted to have their cake and eat it too. And I am quite confident once we get to the merits in front of the Workers' Compensation Commission that they are now going to argue, wait a second, this isn't a compensable injury.
But my question is, if there's a federal court judgment that says that, well, it depends a little bit what you mean by compensable injury. But if a heart attack is the kind of thing that's in the schedules, you know, for workers' compensation, or if, you know, I mean, I don't think anybody's going to argue about course of employment or accidental. I just am interested in the interaction between these two cases and whether it's even possible as a matter of supremacy clause law and also preclusion law for the Illinois Industrial Commission to disregard what the district court and later on this court says.
I agree with you, Your Honor, and that is an argument as frankly as I can be, that if we lose here, that's an argument that would be, and I have suggested to counsel in the workers' compensation proceeding, that needs to be made there.
Been no briefing on that question before the commission, even though it's been pending that long time, and the ruling came down from the district court, because I would think a motion should have been filed utilizing the district court opinion and the district court's finding to have that. You know, we might know more about that if such a motion had been filed.
I agree. All I am told by people who do workers' compensation proceedings is that it's a different animal, and I agree completely with you.
Mm-hmm.
But I am here representing the Dunlaps in this, and because they want to, I think they want to have their cake and eat it too. I can't let them do that and represent my clients zealously.
Well, suppose that that let's just say to pick one of these that the injury is regarded as not compensable under the Act for whatever reason. I take it your position is at that point the exclusivity of workers' compensation goes out the door, and if there's any other reason why this company might be responsible, maybe they don't have cameras around, or maybe, you know, salesmen who are delivering products can have heart attacks and lie on the floor for 5 hours too, or whatever. Your theory is that you are running your premises negligently, and thus should be liable for whatever marginal damage occurs because of that.
I'm not sure I know what you mean by marginal damage.
They didn't cause the heart attack.
Oh,
it's
okay.
Not like he fell into a vat, you know, in all these terrible industrial accidents we read about. He had the heart attack,
right,
or whatever, stroke, heart attack. And so when I say marginal damage, if he had been treated right away, maybe the injuries would have been less. He waits 6 hours or whatever it is, and the injuries are
catastrophic,
more permanent.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
That's what I mean by marginal damage.
Okay. Yeah. So the question, I'm sorry, the question then is...
Well, I'm trying to distinguish. I mean, your theory, what I'm worried about with your theory is that virtually every employee is on the employer's premises of right. And so it looks to me like in virtually every case that somebody loses a workers' comp case, there's your premises liability case. Tell me why that's not true.
Okay. First of all, we're going to have to prove whether or not there's duty, breach, proximate cause, damages that flow from that. Plaintiffs is not going to file that if we've got a clear workers' compensation claim. This falls into that twilight zone. We're not sure. The Illinois Supreme Court has very clearly said that a plaintiff is allowed to pursue both remedies until it becomes clear.
Why is it in the is it only in the twilight zone because the Illinois Industrial Commission is being sluggish?
No, it's because heart attacks have gone both ways. For instance, the twice clean, I can't remember the exact name, but there's a twice clean company, that Inc., that had a heart attack case, was found not compensable. If the person's just a walking heart attack and they happen to have the heart attack 15 minutes after getting work instead of 15 minutes before they get to work, then it's not compensable. So, and we're concerned that that's the argument that's going to be made here. Our position is they can't have it both ways. And the way that any employer that wants to protect itself from defending two of these simply has to stipulate in the workers' compensation proceeding, yes, this is a compensable injury. Then they can litigate the value, all the different issues.
Why would they want to stipulate that? I mean, it seems to me that's really quite against their... Isn't the, let's say, less drastic thing to waive the statute of limitations or something? I mean, it seems to me...
We proposed that to them. That was also a proposal. That there are several alternatives that an employer has other than to just do both these proceedings. And I would agree completely with that. And that was something I think we offered to the district court. Let's just stay the proceedings at the district court level until we find out what the Workers' Compensation Commission did. Of course, none of us anticipated it would be this long.
Okay. Well, if you want to save your last minute.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Why don't you do that? Mr. McPherson.
May it please the Court, good morning. If I could, Judge Wood, respond to a couple of questions that you posed. One was, why has this been languishing in the workers' compensation system for so long? And I, like Mr. Barron, I can't give you any firsthand knowledge on that. My information, though, is that in October of 2003, the workers' compensation proceedings were dismissed for want of prosecution because the plaintiff's counsel was not going to the scheduled appearances. In September of 2004, it was reinstated, and pending in the circuit court is a proceeding to appeal the reinstatement. I don't know the details of that. I haven't been involved in any of that. But my understanding is that it's been languishing because the plaintiff has not been prosecuting it, has not been going forward with it. But that is all beyond the record. The first thing that the appellant's counsel said this morning was it doesn't make any difference whether this man was an employee of the Maytag repairman or whatever.
Well, in terms of his premises liability theory, you know, I can understand why he would say that. If somebody's on the premises of Nestle, and legitimately so, they're not a thief who crept in the middle of the night, but they're there by some form of invitation, there we are. But I actually wanted to get to a more fundamental thing. Nestle is relying on its alleged defenses, which presumably deal with one of the four elements of these claims. I don't know what your defense is. And it seems to me in a sense not consistent with summary judgment standards to assume that you have a good defense. We have to assume the facts in favor of the party who's opposing the motion for summary judgment.
To assume that we have a good defense in the workers' compensation proceedings, Your Honor?
Well, you have this like vague reference in your brief to your defenses, and you're saying, well, you know, you shouldn't have to stipulate in the workers' compensation proceeding that all the elements are there because you have a defense.
Well,
and I don't think anybody's really asking you to do that, since there are other ways of handling this, one of which would simply be to stay the proceedings, one of which would be to waive the statute of limitations. You don't have to give up any rights, not to kind of whipsaw this person between two theories.
Well, if I could, Your Honor, two responses to that. First, the plaintiff suggests that if the employer doesn't want to have these two parallel proceedings going at the same time, that all it has to do, it has an easy remedy. It can admit liability in the underlying workers' comp case.
But Mr. Barron has just said that that's certainly not necessary. And what I'm saying is without admitting liability at all in workers' comp, which actually might be cheaper, you know, given the schedules and so forth, than a tort remedy, but putting that to one side, there are a number of ways in these gray area cases where it's not clear that it's a compensable injury or not, where you can preserve all of your rights in both cases but not have a heads I win, tails you lose outcome for the plaintiff.
Well, Your Honor, the record doesn't support the contention that this is a gray area case, that this is a case in which there's any issue as to whether this case is properly in the Industrial Commission,
well, but
or whether he has a.
Well, but in what sense do you mean? I mean, you agree. So you're agreeing that the injury was an accident.
I'm agreeing that on the basis of the facts that the plaintiff has set forth in the district court,
all
that
I'm saying
this was
is,
an accident.
Well, right. But see, this is important because if we find in the federal court that this is properly a workers' comp case, then that finding should be binding on the Illinois Industrial Commission, and indeed enforceable by injunction even. It's one of the exceptions to the Anti-Injunction Act, injunctions in support of the court's jurisdiction.
Well, Your Honor, this court's judgment is certainly binding on the issues that it holds.
So if we find that it was an accident, that it arose from his employment, that it was received during the course of his employment, and that it's compensable under the Illinois Workers' Compensation Act, then the only thing to figure out is how much money does he get?
Well, Your Honor, if I could, what the district court held was that the district court lacked jurisdiction over this, lacked subject matter jurisdiction because of the... Is that right?
If it may not state a claim, but see, this is the sloppy use of the word jurisdiction that people get into. If you have an affirmative defense that there is a different statutory scheme that applies here and state tort law does not apply, this is a diversity case after all, right? So Illinois law applies. Then that other statutory scheme will apply, and in a primary jurisdiction sense, we would say you have not stated a claim under state tort law because there's this other claim. It doesn't mean that there's no power on the part of the court to adjudicate the case. You guys are of diverse citizenship. I take it the amount exceeds $75,000, the alleged amount. Is that right?
That is the claim, Your Honor. Yes.
Okay, and nobody's saying, you know, this is really a $2,000 case.
We are not, Your Honor.
Right. So it's not subject matter jurisdiction.
Your Honor, our position is that Illinois law, which absolutely does govern this, Illinois law absolutely forbids a common law cause of action under the set of facts
which
that the plaintiff
no
has
claim
posited.
Stated. Right, which means there would be no claim stated if we were in Madison County or if we were in the central or southern, whichever district of Illinois we decide to be in at the moment.
That's
but it doesn't
true.
Mean that the court has no subject matter jurisdiction. It means the court's going to make a binding decision about whether the elements of a claim have been stated. And if the elements fall within the exclusive workers' comp bailiwick, then that's where the case belongs. But that itself is a binding decision.
The decision of the judgment of the district court and the opinion of this court certainly would be binding on the parties. That's absolutely true. The judgment of the district court, however, was that the plaintiff had failed to state a claim because his only remedy is in the industrial commission. Now, in finding that, the court went through the Mirbray factors and found that on the summary judgment record, the plaintiff had failed to meet his burden of showing any of the four elements that could take it out of the workers' comp.
But it's a little tricky for Nestle to say, well, because we're not telling this injury, you haven't shown us that this injury is not compensable under the Act. You know, there's a, I don't know, what it reminds me of actually is a judicial estoppel theory, you know, that Nestle is going to be held responsible, I think, if you take inconsistent positions before the two fora.
Well, Your Honor, absolutely, we don't want to take inconsistent positions.
No.
But the position that we're taking right now, and it's not a position, it's the facts. The plaintiff alleges, and the undisputed summary judgment record shows that this man was an employee. During his shift, he had a heart attack. During his shift, as a consequence of his work, he suffered these injuries. Under those facts that the plaintiff has posited, the district court properly dismissed it for failure to state a claim.
Which
because
means
his exclusive
that the
remedy
industrial
is in the
commission
workers.
Then cannot dismiss it, saying it doesn't fit mm-hmm. within the workers' comp standard.
I think that the industrial
that
commission
issue has
absolutely
been taken out of their hands.
Absolutely has jurisdiction over this case. Absolutely.
And if it finds that the injury, this isn't a fancy kind of injury. This isn't, a heart attack is a heart attack. So, again, there's a matter of law, perhaps, as to if it's 15 minutes before. This man had been on his shift for 2.5 hours, as I understand, when it happened. I just don't know how we actually can avoid making this decision for the Industrial Commission that the only thing to figure out is how much money.
Your Honor, I would dispute the fundamental basis of the plaintiff's claim here, of its contentions in this court and in the district court, that this case is in any kind of gray area. The plaintiff attempts to rely on the CISPRO case. And
so where does he not get his money? Where he's saying gray area is for workers' comp. What legitimate defense do you have in the workers' comp case?
Your Honor, I'm not familiar with the record in the workers' comp case. I'm familiar with the record in this case.
So there's no defense that you know about? I mean,
your opponent
sort of threw down the gauntlet in the reply brief. I can't believe you're not prepared to answer that question.
Well, Your Honor, the plaintiff's counsel a moment ago said he's not familiar with what the proceedings are in the workers' compensation proceedings. What I'm saying is that
Well, you must know who the lawyer is. I mean, when the reply brief says Nestle carefully eschews setting forth the basis upon which it's denying the workers' comp claim, it's a little odd that you aren't familiar with what that basis would be.
Well, Your Honor, this is I'm the lawyer in the federal court.
Are there no pleadings filed?
No, as the plaintiff says.
In the workers' comp case?
Your Honor, they have not, because the plaintiff has not proceeded on the case. The case has not proceeded to any point where any of the issues have been joined. That was the first thing I was trying to say. In his reply brief, the plaintiff says, page 2, Nestle has effectively avoided filing responsive pleading in the underlying workers' compensation case. Another way of saying that, Your Honor, is that the plaintiff has not pushed the workers' compensation case to the point where the issues have been joined, where there have been any factual determinations, where the case has reached a point where Nestle has had to do that.
Hypothetically, what would be a defense? Forget about this case. It's not anything I would hold you to in this case. But hypothetically, in a workers' comp case, what would an employer say?
Well, Your Honor, in a workers' comp case, what might happen is the sort of thing that happened in the Twice Over Clean Against Industrial Commission case. That was a case where the fellow was sick. He had a 90% blockage of his heart. His own doctor testified that he was going to have a heart attack, characterized him as a heart attack waiting to happen.
Right.
Under those circumstances, the employer is not obligated to compensate him under the workers' compensation system because his work did not contribute to his injury.
And does that mean then it's not within the exclusive jurisdiction of the Industrial Commission? Because now he's not in the workers' compensation system. What about the tort claim?
Does that mean that he's
not? Which is a different kind of claim, you know, that you don't have the right kind of cameras on your premises, you don't have, you know, guards walking around to see if people have collapsed in the hallways or whatever. I mean, is it?
It's not an either-or thing, Your Honor, and that's what I wanted to say. It's that the question isn't, does he get compensated in workers' compensation for having a heart attack, or is his employer liable under common law because he had a heart attack? There sure is a third possibility, is that the employer was not negligent.
Oh, of course, and the employer would have the opportunity of proving that in the tort case.
Well, Your Honor.
The employer would win, for all I know. But
not under Illinois law. He would not, because the statutes say clearly that the only remedy an employee who suffers an injury at work has is in the Industrial Commission. The law could not be any clearer under Section 305.5 and 305.11 that that's his remedy, that's the place he has to seek it, and I'll ask that the judgment of the district court be affirmed.
Okay. You have a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Right at the very end, we got to right where we are, which is that they do want to have their cake and eat it, too. I want to go to page 8 of the district court's opinion. First sentence of the last paragraph, the district court found the alleged injuries are also compensable under the Act. That's what the district court said. Couldn't be clearer. But now they want to say, well, maybe, maybe not. And their argument, and now we blur the tort issue with the workers' compensation exclusivity. The Urbis case.
Having that net nugget from the district court, why'd you bother appealing?
I'm sorry. Again, with an utmost amount of caution, and I know you've got enough to do here without me bringing you more work, but if the Industrial Commission does not feel that it's...
If that rule, the Industrial Commission, notwithstanding, they have to follow the law. If that finding of the district court had remained final, it would be binding on the Industrial Commission.
I agree with you, and I believe, and I'll just tell you, we had this discussion, we'd be litigating that issue, and we'd be at some appellate court arguing that issue at some point. Therefore, I don't want them to be able to be in a position to argue that we allowed an erroneous order to stand and that we attempted to use what was not necessarily a final order and we negligently allowed that order to become final. But the Urbis case, and I know my time's up, just completely contradicts the argument that was just made here that we have to have it both ways. Urbis clearly indicates that if we're not in workers' comp, we can bring a tort action.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you to both counsel. We will take the case under advisement. Proceed.